Hello, and welcome to episode 42 of the Planning Period Podcast. You're at Breakroom. I'm your host, Brad Trepler. This week on the show, I am the guest. During the VoiceEd Radiothon last month, I invited Chip Harbin from episode 34 of the podcast to join me for a live episode of my show. Our idea was to flip the script on my show and put the guest in charge for an hour and have me be the guest answering the questions. Chip and I focus a lot on digital curriculum, how to implement a one-to-one program, why you should embrace technology in the classroom, and some all-around silliness, because it's Chip and that's just how he is. So, sit back and enjoy episode 42 of the Planning Period Podcast, Flip the Script with Chip Harbin.
Good afternoon. Welcome to this episode of the Planning Period Podcast. I am your flip the script host, Chip Harbin, here to do a different style show where I am getting the pleasure of interviewing a very, very good close friend of mine, Mr. Brad Schreffler. You know him from this show and 11,000 other things that Brad does in the world of education. We've worked together for a while. We've known each other for a while. Our kids are friends. We're meshed. So this should be an interesting show. It's my plan to ask a variation of the same questions that Brad asks all of his guests, but to keep him from stealing any of his favorite answers from his guests and not being original, which not really sure that he would do that anyway. And I know this is audio, so you can't see me winking as I say that. Anyway, I hope you enjoy it. And I am joined today by your favorite podcaster and my favorite educator, Mr. Brad Schreffler.
Hey, Chip, how's it going? Thanks for having me on the show.
Hey, thanks for coming in to your own house. I appreciate it.
Sometimes I have ideas and they seem good. And then once I actually get to the execution phase, I almost immediately regret them.
It's the moment that you think to yourself, Chip should be the one to come in on this, is when things start to take a negative turn.
Yeah.
So why don't you tell the audience a little about yourself, where you came from, your journey through education, for those who haven't listened to the podcast from its inception and don't know your history? Why don't you give them a little background?
All right. Well, I came into education kind of backwards. I went to school for music ed at the very beginning of my college experience and then did not finish my first full year of music education at UCF, University of Central Florida, National Champs. And I didn't finish my first year, switched to business because of time commitments and everything else. Got into the business world outside once I got done with my degree and realized I hated it. And needed another job fast, went into subbing because I knew they'd hire anybody that didn't wear jeans. And I became a substitute teacher and realized that I had started college in the right place, even though I had abandoned it. And so I went and figured out how I could teach without having a degree in education, which in Florida is scary easy. And yeah, and then I became a teacher and I've slowly been growing across my years of education until I've developed a passion for this industry and this field and this thing that we call education. And from there, the podcast was born.
So what role do you hold these days in education? What are your multiple hats that you wear at school each day or in the education community? Cause you reach far more than just your campus.
Yeah. So I'm a podcaster for the Planning Period Podcast that we're kind of listening to now. And my day job, I'm the curriculum resource teacher at a large high school in Central Florida. That basically means I'm in charge of all professional development, building the PD calendar and how we're going to teach the staff and what we're going to teach the staff. I did the last 2 years as the digital coach. And so I got to focus on our one-to-one rollout where we rolled out laptops to every single student, which is, you know, something that you and I were both heavily involved with. And yeah, so I also run the student tech support group who have their own podcast now and, you know, kind of hands in a lot of pots, as you might say. I don't know why you put hands in pots.
So
I don't think that's the right phrase.
You got to wash them somehow.
Oh, Brad. Okay.
You can't just, I mean, they're too big to put in the dishwasher.
Okay.
Cause it takes up too much space, too much real estate. So as you're talking, I'm coming up with questions. I kind of want to add on to your questions. But just knowing you and knowing a lot about you, and you mentioned that you developed this passion for the field of education. And I see you in recent years, focusing a lot on helping the adults around you in education, grow professionally and become better at their practice. What would you say your ratio of passion for educating students to educating adults is right now? Would you say that that's something that you find yourself enjoying more? Or would you say that you still hold a more a strong affection towards educating youth?
Hmm.
Does that make sense?
No, it makes sense. I'm just not sure. I kind of went into educating adults as a way to educate more kids, if that makes any sense. Like as a coach, I am able to impact the 120, 200 teachers, depending on the year we have at our school. And they are then able to impact all of the students, the 4,000, 3,000, whatever number that may be. So I think I kind of went into educating adults that, you know, with the intention of having a bigger impact on kids. And, you know, it kind of depends on the day. There are definitely days where I'm loving that I'm popping into rooms and doing coaching with teachers, and that's awesome. And then there are days where I just want to go into my classroom and work with my student tech support kids and close the door and just talk about whatever ridiculous topic is on our minds that day and go into a higher level discussion with them. So I think it just kind of depends on the day. So I guess 50-50 maybe. Or maybe 75% kids, 25% adults.
Do you get the same kind of, do you get the same kind of like satisfaction or I guess reward when you kind of flip that switch in the mind of an adult that maybe has been resistant to like technology changes or updates in curriculum and things? In your school where you see them go, oh, and you automatically, you see their teaching practice change because of something that you've been working with them and you see their student scores start to go up. That has to feel rewarding, but does it feel as rewarding as taking a student who's struggling and identifying their needs and helping them flip that switch? Or is it, once again, is that like a 50-50 thing?
Huh. You know, I always say that there is a thing about teaching when, in the traditional classroom in front of kids, that there's a high that comes with that moment when you see the light bulb, right? Like, you know, right. If we were to throw it as a pedagogical term, that anecdotal data that they have learned something when you right. can see it, you know, there's something about that that just clicks. And I don't know that you can ever not want that once you've done it.
Right.
But at the same time, you're right. Like when I have that same sort of effect, it's not quite as immediate. It's not quite as in your face with teachers. I feel like with adults, it's not quite as like obvious, and it is more of a process to get them to change habit and get them to change practice because they feel like they are adults and are grown. And so therefore they're not quick to just like light bulb moment go off.
Right.
But once you get it, once you can point to something and be like, look, that like I had a part in that. I did part of that. There's a high to it. Yeah, I think it's there. I think there, I don't know if it's as good or better or worse or different. I think it's a different experience, a different high.
Interesting. So you have your typical four questions or three questions. I have a fourth that I want to ask you, as well. But, I want to take your questions and I want to change them a little bit because I spoke a little bit about this on the episode of Planning Period Podcast that I was on recently, about kind of the culture that's created when the focus is what are the problems in education? And I think continuing to ask a question like that kind of leads people to constantly be, analyzing the negatives, right? So instead of continuing that today, I'd like to ask you what you feel is one of the most positive aspects of education in today's world or in recent years? What is one of the most impactful positive leaps that education that has been made in education?
All right. So this feels kind of cheap, but I'm going to go with it anyways. And it's funny, even flipping the questions, I still like get the struggle. Like I understand what my guests go through when I ask them these questions, because even flipping them, it's like, how do I narrow it down to just one? It's so hard. But I think I will go with technology. It's hard because on some level there's a lot of problems with what implementation looks like, but on another, there's some great things happening. And so I can speak to what my day is like, what my context is. And in our district, every high school and most middle schools are now 1-to-1. And the state of Florida in general has required a significant amount of investment go into technology and that all students have access. And I think that's a really good thing. I think having access to technology, getting our hands on technology is going to be really critical for the future. And I like that. I love that that's something we're doing. You know, I always quote this stat, but you know, it's like the whole like 70% of jobs that our kids have don't even exist yet thing, right? Like that's that whole thing. They're going to be solving problems that haven't even been imagined with tools that haven't been invented. And the whole thing goes on and on and on. And it's true on some level. And I think that it's really powerful that people are realizing that this is a need. You know, you think about a conference like ISTE, you know, International Society for Technology Education. There's over 100,000 educators come to that conference every summer. On their summer, when they're not working, they're coming in. Most of them, a lot of them have paid to be there. They paid the registration fee. They've paid their travel. They've paid their housing while they're there out of their own pocket because they want to learn about the ways you can incorporate technology. And even all the presenters there are people who are already doing this in their day job. So it's like, there are movements happening in the right direction. And I think technology has the power to be tremendously disruptive. And we're somewhat accepting of that disruption. So I think I'd have to point to technology.
Okay. It's interesting to talk about that because I always in the back of my mind wonder, is the need for technology in schools, is that moving? And I understand on campuses where they have people like you employed, it's not as much of an issue as it would be somewhere else. But do you see a danger in the need for technology in schools moving forward faster than the ability to integrate that technology into the schools with current staff members? You see what I mean?
Yeah, no, I do. I see a danger for sure. We were lucky in our position that, you know, not, it could have been anybody. It didn't need to be me. I'm, you know, whatever, but it could have been anybody, but we had a principal who recognized the need for someone, you know, who said like, yeah, we do need someone to focus on this because it could become a problem. You know, it's funny. We were talking last night, we were hanging out with a bunch of teachers after school and we were mentioning my podcast and the questions we ask. And when we said the first question, someone immediately said the biggest problem in education is technology.
Right.
And I was like, right. I 100% wholeheartedly disagree. Like, I could not disagree with you more, but I also see where that person's coming from. Because putting technology in school can be a humongous distraction to the kids. It can completely keep them off task and off focus and not have a clue what they're doing and make it worse. It can prevent learning. I mean, there's been recent studies that have come out and shown that taking notes on a laptop is significantly less effective. And having laptops in classroom is actually detrimental to everyone in the room, even the ones that don't have laptops. You know, they've shown a ton of studies in college classrooms. And where you don't have someone who's dedicated to that transition, where you don't have someone who's looking at the situation on the big picture level or an administration that's looking at it on the big picture level, you might see those studies and say, okay, well, then we're not going to invest in 1-to-1. We're not going to invest in technology. But the real lesson from all those studies, the real lesson from all these problems is that you're looking at the wrong problem. Yes, putting a laptop in a classroom can reduce the effectiveness of a lecture, but the lecture wasn't effective the first time before you added a laptop. Like, you're looking at the wrong problem. You can't just, you know, our district used that term, like, digitize versus digital, right? Like, if you just scan all your worksheets and make them PDFs, you haven't fixed anything. You're saving trees. And these laptops are way too expensive to ever make that a valuable statement. Like, we're saving paper. We're saving so much. We're saving dollars per student for these $650 computers. That's a good investment. Like, that's not the point, right? We have to be looking at the technology as more than just a tool, more than just a way to replace what we're doing now, more than just a way to do it a different way, but look at it as a paradigm shift, as lame as that sounds, but look at it as a paradigm shift in what we're asking kids to do, how we're asking them to do it, and what we expect them to learn, because the definition of knowledge is changing and will change more and more over time because of technology.
I have a follow-up question. Before I ask that, repeat what you just said again. Those few things that you said you need to focus on, because my follow-up question is going to be related to that. Do you remember what you just said?
We have to focus on a change in the way we're teaching, what students are producing, what we expect them to learn, and what we declare as knowledge.
I wanted you to repeat that because my follow-up question is going to be, if people are listening to your show as a way to grow, or listening to your show as a way to develop professionally, if they are inching closer to a situation where their school is going to be one-to-one and they want to get in on that, or they want to be a part of it, or they want to assist their school in that, from someone who's done it at an extremely large high school, with a lot of barriers being placed in their way, and a lot of very...
It's a very political way to put that.
Yes. And you did it incredibly successfully. And I loved being a part of it. I loved working with you while you were doing it. But for someone else, what are some tips you can give them to stay a few steps ahead of these problems that could occur when you implement technology? What are some things they need to be looking out for?
Well, number one, you kind of hit on it. You know, yes, I was involved in making that happen at our school, but it was not me that made that happen in our school. And I think that's a critical difference. It was our principal, our assistant principal over technology, me. It was all of the DCTL team. So you and all the other people who were part of that process, because we knew from the beginning that it was absolutely critical we had a team around us. And part of that was a size issue, right? Like, I mean, we had 200 something teachers, literally 200 something classroom teachers at our school, at one high school.
230 something.
Yeah, it was ridiculous. And so I couldn't possibly be everywhere. We had to have just more bodies involved. But at the same time, we said, we need to do more than that. We need to lean on those other people that can be experts or are experts. And it's not even that it was people who were already experts necessarily, but we found the people who had a proficiency and said, okay, what do we do? Like, what do we talk about? What do we change? And then we helped as a team. You know, you had a strength in one place and you boosted up the others, and we worked together to make something. So I think number one, you need to identify the people that can help that transition happen and that see it as more than just a one-to-one replacement. It's not a way to replace paper. So you need to find the people that are looking to make the kind of change you want to make. And number two, once you've found that team, then you need to work towards what is your vision? And there's a lot of ways to take this thing, right? Like, there's a lot of, you could say that my goal is to get my students on my campus to be content creators, right? Like, that may be your focus. And then whatever you teach the staff needs to go in that direction. You can work on, I want my students to do this, or I want my students to be college and career ready, or whatever your lofty goal is, and work towards those. But then the other big pitfall to avoid, and I think this is where I'm still getting frustration a little bit, is look at the technology as more than just a tool. Don't just teach the button clicks and the how to use what you have. Teach the reasons, teach the pedagogical strategies, and give them a choice of tools to how to get there. Because our staff, as I've said on the show before, we've changed platforms three times. We were a Microsoft 365 school in year one. We were Office, or we were Google for Educators, Google Classroom, Google Apps for Ed the year two. And now this year we're still Google, but we also added Canvas as a full featured LMS. Our staff has been pulled in so many directions after year after year after year, and completely had to redesign the way they teach, which has been a a big pain. It's been a big pain point for me supporting that staff. But what has been an unintended consequence is most of my teachers that are using technology regularly and using it well aren't focused on the tool. They aren't thinking about like, oh, I'm using Google Classroom today. They're thinking about the goals, and right. they just are using whatever tool they can to get there. And that's, I think, really critical is they're not tool dependent. They're not tools trapped. And there's so much push in so many things, especially when you start looking at technology podcasts and everybody else, everybody kind of niches out like, oh, this is the Google class. This is what you do if you're a Microsoft school. And this is what you do if you're a Google school. And this is what you do if you're a one-to-one with Chromebook or this. And everybody starts to niche out where they are. And we need to get away from that. We need to get the nouns out of our PD. So not focus on Google Classroom, not focus on whatever, and focus on the pedagogical skills and use the tools as the vehicles to get us there.
As you're talking about this, I'm looking at your Twitter feed and I'm seeing that we're getting comments and questions. And now I'm wondering if, since we are live and since we do have people listening and people asking questions, if we should just abandon your questions and we should give them some advice. But this is not your show today. This is my show.
You're the host of the Planning Period podcast.
So that's what we're going to do. We have someone checking in on Twitter who says, Paul McGuire says, a leader who understands about tech integration, what happens when this is missing? And that's also preceded by him commenting that it's a problem in Ontario elementary schools where there are no tech specialists, depends on the admin, and they do not necessarily have a background in tech. One thing I'll say about that is I don't necessarily have a background in tech. And quite a few people who were on our tech integration team didn't have a background in tech, but what we did have was motivation and a passion to want to learn these things and to want to grow and to be a part of the future of what was going to be education in our school system. And it was fun and it was exciting and we got to learn all these new things and we got to see all these new things. And I think, aside from a leader who understands about tech integration, having people on your campus that share that same passion for wanting your schools to move forward towards the future of what education is going to be soon, I think is an important key in making that tech integration happen. If you don't have a leader in your school that is savvy with tech integration or wants tech integration or is willing to move forward towards that, other than, filing for grants and trying to raise the money yourself, or integrating technology in classrooms where educators are willing to do that, and then using those classrooms as exemplars to show the usefulness of integrating technology into classrooms as a way to make your point. What other advice would you say for a school where there are teachers who see the need for technology integration but don't necessarily have a leader who encourages that or who is willing to make that step?
I think if you don't have a leader, what I would say, if you are a teacher who is driven by it, right? If you're a teacher who sees the big picture, right? Reach across your hall. And I can never say enough, stop thinking about the four walls of your classroom. Because yes, you can impact your 125, 130, 25 kids, whatever your number is, you can impact that number. But reach across the hall. Make your four walls 8 walls of that person's room and your room. Or your whole hallway, like teach your whole hallway how to do it. Offer Wednesday, a short PD, a before school PD, a planning period time. Like, hey, do it informally if you want to. Like if your admin's not supporting it, just say, hey guys, I'm available. We saw this even when we had supportive PD, if you remember right, people would be like, they would just email the whole school and just say, hey, I've got the hang on this whole Canvas thing. If you want to come over to my room, I'm going to be available after school for 30 minutes. Come over and ask questions. Or I've got to hang on this whole OneNote thing. Come visit me for a half hour. I'll be glad to help you. And even without the administrative support, that was never even approved. And we had a supportive admin. Like, that's totally fine. Go do that. Like, offer up what you want to see and offer it up to everybody. Like, hey, I want this. Like, come. I want you guys to see this. And again, offer up more than just the tool, right? Like when people come to you, if you're doing a grassroots PD, let's call it, let's just make a term for it right here and now. Grassroots PD, you want to do grassroots professional development. You say, okay, come see me. I'll offer you training on this. Make sure you give the pedagogy side. like give the, here's how you do the tool. Here's the click, click, click. Here's what you do once you've done that. Here's how it works with students. Show them samples of what's in your classroom. Do that kind of stuff. Like, you know, and if you got to do it grassroots because your admin doesn't support it, do it, but it become that voice. And I'll tell you what, that's how I got this job. I mean, if you remember right, and I've said, I walked up to Doug and I said, hey, when we go one-to-one next year, we need someone dedicated to it. We need someone that does this, 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 this. And I laid out exactly what a digital coach would do in my mind. And he said, yeah, that kind of makes sense. And I was like, and by the way, I'm going to be the one to do that. And he goes, okay, yeah. I mean, you know, so it's make that job for yourself. You know, you can help yourself while you help everyone else. And the more, you know, if we're all in this thing to impact kids, right? Like we're all here to impact kids. Right. Why not double up how many kids, triple up how many kids you're impacting by helping their teachers?
Right. I mean, if you look around at the level of technology that's present in the lives of students these days, it's difficult as a person to say that it's not a necessity in schools, because they're using it and they're using it like wildfire and they're not necessarily using it responsibly. And so I think that's another incredible lesson that kids learn from having technology integrated into schools. You're smiling.
I know you hit the edge of something that I also think another critical misstep that I think a lot of teachers take is the, I agree with you wholeheartedly. The amount of technology they use is really critical and the amount of technology they will use going forward, it makes it important. But one huge misstep a lot of people take is they say, oh, they're all digital natives. They know how to do this.
We've had this discussion before.
Oh, it's the worst.
And it's so wrong.
You put a keyboard in front of these kids and they lose their minds to the point. I finally realized this, by the way. You give a keyboard to a student who has never really used anything but a phone or a tablet before. They don't know what the shift key does.
No.
They hit caps lock to capitalize the first letter of a sentence. They do caps lock, first letter, and then hit caps lock again to undo it. And I finally realized recently they do that because that's how their phone works. Like their phone doesn't have really a shift button. You have to tap shift and then tap the letter. They don't understand that you can tap two keys at the same time. That's the most basic function of a computer and they don't understand it. And we always act like the kids should just get it and they don't. They get iPhones. Maybe if you go iPad one-to-one, maybe it's a different story. That's not my experience, so I can't say. But if you go with anything with a keyboard, watch them type and then pull your hair out because that drives me insane.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's also, the typing like you text with using like the single letter U instead of the word U.
They do that in writing too. Like on a piece of paper, they'll do the same thing.
But yeah, I mean, they're incredibly proficient at, using Instagram and Snapchat and whatever else they're using. But when it comes to using tools that are going to be effective for them moving forward, office tools, word processing software, database software, spreadsheet software, things like that. They have no idea. So they have the mentality to be able to use these things and use them well once they learn how to use them. But they are just as much a novice as anyone else.
Well, I think you were with me when we walked another high school that it was a year ahead of us in their one-to-one, right? And I think I forget what class we're in. It might've even been a drama class or something like that, but we were in a class and the teacher said to me and our principal at the time, and he goes, you know, they are digital natives. They are tremendously proficient at using technology for entertainment. Mm-hmm. What they're not any good at is using technology for learning. And he goes, that's the paradigm shift. The paradigm shift isn't from paper to digital. The paradigm shift isn't going from, writing your notes in class to typing them on a computer. That's not the paradigm shift. The paradigm shift is making these students understand that technology can be used for learning. And that's the paradigm shift that kids have to take.
And it's looking at a book. It's looking at a worksheet. It's looking at something that was there to help them learn and then sitting a laptop next to it and saying, This worksheet is a grain of sand in the world of information, but I can teach you how to use this incredibly well. But if you learn how to teach kids how to use that laptop effectively to learn, you're saying this laptop is the Sahara Desert of information compared to that worksheet.
That one
if you learn how to use it correctly,
yep.
If you learn how to use it effectively to learn, it's all the information you'll ever need if you learn how to be a self-directed learner with this device, with this access to information, if you're using it to grow and not using it just to entertain. Okay, so we got like 25 minutes.
That was good. That was good. We got some good stuff in there, I feel like.
I like it. Being live is strange because I keep forgetting that this isn't I'll just edit that out later, which you never do anyway.
It's also interesting that it's not like it's easy to forget that it's not just you and me talking to each other at a table when we're in the same place.
Trying not to acknowledge that. I'm trying to ignore the fact that anybody's listening. The Twitter comments make it a little more difficult to do that. So I'll ask another one of your questions and we'll see where that goes. But what is something or multiple things that you did in your classroom or that you do in your classroom that you've looked back on and realized that you needed to change? And how did you go about evaluating your own practice and deciding what would be the most effective change? So instead of saying, what did you do well in your classroom? What did you see other teachers doing well that you thought that would work really well in my classroom? Why didn't I think of that? I'm glad that I am a part of this team that I could see that this other person was doing something I wasn't doing.
I mean, I have to point to my PLN, like my online PLN, because there are so many phenomenal educators out there that I have interacted with that I just wish I was as cool as them. Like I'm not even kidding. Like I feel, and I know like imposter syndrome is a real thing and everybody gets it, but I have it so bad sometimes where I will even say things. And then I think like that probably like that sounded way better than it actually was. Like really it was a nightmare. And I just am trying to make it sound like it's so rough. Like, but I think if I had to point to one, I can't point to one thing, but one thing that comes to mind, I will say this, is I'm often guilty of not giving my students enough structure on activities. And I'm still learning that balance where I used to give, in my beginning years, I used to give way too much structure to essentially all my kids were doing was following directions. And then I've gone all the way to 180 that where I give them absolutely no structure and say, here's a blank canvas, do whatever you want for the next hour and just make something cool. And that doesn't work for them either. And I'm having to balance, and I still don't think I have the perfect balance. And I think part of it is because that balance will change student to student and will change day to day. You know, one day they might need more balance than the other because of all the other factors going on. But I still don't think I've found the balance of that, of giving them the framework to be creative and also getting my intended goals, or at least getting them to the standards that I want them to get to. I just don't know that I found that balance. I never feel like I've perfected grading. I hate it. I really just wish I could eliminate it entirely, but I can't. So I get where I would love to be, but I haven't mastered grading within the framework I have to work. I haven't figured out the way to what I see as a very oppressive, very ridiculous system that we have to submit our grades in, but also still incorporating that freedom aspect I want my kids to have. I don't feel like I've mastered that. I don't.
So let me ask you, going on grading. Because I feel like I should ask you what your current philosophy on grading is, but I feel like that's going to get you 70% hate mail, 30% yay, I'm with you, because everybody sees it differently and everybody has a different opinion on it. So I'll rephrase that question or ask it, maybe try to lead in that direction. If you don't place importance on grades, right? If you're not teaching your students, if you want your students to obtain the intrinsic motivation to learn things because of growth and not to learn things because of a number, because of a grade that's attached to it, how do you create that intrinsic motivation in your students that gives them the, I want to learn this because I enjoy the feeling of success and learning something new, or I enjoy the feeling of growth, instead of I'm doing this work so that I can get a good grade? Because I think once you can do that, then grading becomes less important than students showing mastery of, you know what I mean?
No, I do. So I think they're all connected. Technology gives us the ability to reach in our classrooms. Technology in our classrooms gives us the ability to reach outside the walls of our classroom and well outside the walls of our school and outside the borders of our state, country, whatever, right? And I think that's the critical component here. So students aren't going to be motivated to intrinsically learn. The definition of learning is not what it used to be. Like, they don't feel the need to learn or memorize or retain knowledge because they have instant access to all of the world's knowledge. They have the Sahara Desert of knowledge in their phone every single second of every single day. So the idea of memorizing and learning in the way we look at it, in the way it's been taught to us, the way we were taught to learn, it doesn't have value to them. And it's not ever going to, I don't think. I think there's a paradigm shift that has to happen there. So instead, what the value has to come from is not the learning. It can't come from the grade. It can't come from the numeric value. They really can't even get the idea of, like, it comes from wanting to go to college. You know, best case scenario,
right,
they are intrinsically motivated by the grade, not because of the grade, but because they don't want their parents to yell at them. That's like, it's literally a path of least resistance. It's less time to just do the stupid work than it is to get yelled at and lectured by their parents all the time. So I think that's really what it is. But I think where the goal has to come from, where the motivation has to come from, is in letting them around the room. And not just like, oh, you'll use this when you're older, but I mean literally sharing it outside of that. So, and I can use my students as an example recently. I have been trying to find that perfect balance of grading within my tech support kids, my student interns, for 3 years now. It's been a 3-year battle of finding that balance where I'm regularly disappointed in them and me at the same time, where I give them something and I have all these great expectations and then they don't meet them and I go, oh, you guys are killing me. And then I realize, but no, really, it's my fault. What did I do wrong? And I realized I gave them too much freedom or not enough freedom, or it felt like busy work to them and they didn't get the connections and all these things were wrong. I had all these visions and I wasn't getting there. And now we started this podcast, this student podcast that we're doing, Studecademy.
With the name, I
love just it. It's amazing. Studecademy. It
drives me nuts. Go.
Great. It's great. Studecademy. Now we started this and I have specifically told them, okay, everyone in all of 7 periods of student tech support are getting A's, period. All 7 periods are getting A's this quarter. Done. I don't care what you do from here until the end of the 9 weeks, you're all getting A's. But let's do this podcast. And what we're going to do is each week, you guys are going to each period, one kid from each period will pick a topic for their class to talk about. And if it's something interesting, we'll record it and we'll make it a podcast. That was it. I was like, that's all we're going to do. Get involved. Don't get involved. Share. Don't share. Whatever. I have never seen my kids work so hard on the non-tech support stuff they do. They are literally ripping apart. Like, they're every single day I walk in, more stuff has been written on the whiteboards around my room. I have whiteboards all the way against the back wall and all the way against the front wall. And more stuff is taking over these boards every single day because that's all they think about. They come in and they immediately start writing. And they're like, okay, well, I had this idea. I had this. One kid said to me yesterday, he goes, oh, I got to write this on the board. I had this idea while I was on the toilet yesterday. And I'm like, and as funny as that was, and the class was like, oh, I was like, no, actually, that's where I do a significant amount of my thinking.
All the best ideas,
right?
Are on the toilet or in the shower, right? Those two places is like you finish bathing and everything is done, and you just are not ready to get out of the hot water.
Yeah,
and so you just stand there. Like every morning before I start my day, I just stand in the shower for like 10 minutes, just pondering things. And so, yeah. So anyway, continue. What was this?
It was just a topic idea. He's like, this is something we could talk about. And he just wrote it up on the board when he came to class. He's like, right away. I've got my kids every day. I've got multiple students every day going to their classes that they're supposed to be in, getting a pass and coming back down to my room because they just want to be there talking about the podcast, doing something that has value. Yesterday, we got on a call with, Peter Cameron's class in Canada, in Ontario, or somewhere, I don't know, Canada, somewhere. We did a call with his fifth and sixth grade students talking about podcasting. They were so excited just to talk about podcasting. And it was just like, there were technical difficulties, internet went in and out, but we just talked for like 20 minutes and just like, they asked us questions about podcasting. Then they asked us questions about like, what are their difference makers? Cause that's Peter's show. And like, my kids were so excited. I had 5 different teachers, like, what is it you're doing? Cause this kid asked if he could get out during fourth period. I'm like, oh yeah, we're talking to people in Canada. No big deal.
And really serious, important stuff that can't be missed. Please send them over.
Exactly. I need them now.
We're testing.
I was right. It is Ontario. Paul coming in for the safe. It's Ontario. Thunder Bay.
Yeah.
Sometimes. But I, you know, it's, that is what it is. The value has to come from them realizing that it means something. They're not going to do it because it means something to me. They're not going to do it because it means something for their future. They're going to do it because it means something right here, right now. That's from earlier.
I know. I'm just like, man, I thought of something. Oh yeah. Everything that you're saying just, makes me want to take a week off and just come hang out in your classroom for a week and just watch these kids.
You're welcome anytime.
Oh,
I bet your principal would even approve it. Or maybe a day. He might not approve a week.
Yeah, maybe a day. We'll see. Or maybe I'll get sick. I'm not feeling so well today. Okay. So then, let's see. I don't know where
we got 15 minutes.
Okay. So let's move on to my variation of your third question.
This is where I get to be negative.
It is. And that's why I wanted to pull that out of you. Cause you always sound so optimistic. Tell me a story or tell me something about the worst teacher that you ever had or that you ever had the displeasure of working with, or what was it about this educator that you feel would deem them the worst teacher you've ever known? And I hate to say that, because even saying the term worst teacher to me doesn't necessarily mean that this person is a bad teacher. Maybe they just need assistance. Maybe they need help. Maybe they're struggling and they're not asking for help. Because anyone who's willing to sign up and go into the field of education, I think at least deserves to be worked with. But I know that there are some out there who just refuse to walk that line. So tell me a little bit about your worst teacher experience.
I will think back to my own high school experience, because I refuse to talk about anybody I currently work with. That's the worst teacher. But no, I will think back to my own high school experience, and I cannot remember this man's name to save my life. I don't remember what he did, what he was like. I remember he was old, and he taught, I think it was geometry, and it's a well known thing about me that I don't like math. I don't like math. What I don't always talk about is I'm actually pretty good at math. I can't calculate in my head to save my life, but conceptually I understand math. I'm fairly decent at it. And so I was in this, I think it was like an honors geometry class or whatever. And he would just lecture all day. He would just lecture and he would do diagrams and examples on the board and walk you through problems. And we were just sitting there taking notes or whatever. And I've never been a note taker. I remember things well. I just kind of run with them, whatever. So I would instead write long form letters, notes back and forth with my girlfriend at the time. And so we had like a spiral notebook that we'd pass back and forth. And I always made sure I had it during, I think it was second period. I needed to have it because I was going to be bored out of my mind if I didn't have something to write during second period. I would just write and write and write. Never paid any attention. But my buddy Carrick, who sat next to me, would pay attention because he was a little more of a goody two shoes than me. But he was also a bit of a troublemaker. And so what he would do is at least we had long block periods. So the classes were like an hour and 45 minutes, right? And this guy would just lecture for an hour and 45 minutes. And so
that's effective.
Yeah, it's very effective. So he would go, Carrick would just occasionally 2-3 times a period tap me on the shoulder, because he's sitting next to me, and tap me on the shoulder. And all I would do is look up from the note I was in the middle of, look at the board for a second, and then raise my hand. And inevitably this guy would call on me and he'd go, yes, he was this like really gruff old voice. He'd be like, "Ruff." And I'm like, oh, I think, where you have that up there, you meant like that, you got that math wrong up there. Like that's wrong. and he would look at me. He'd look back at the board. He'd look at me. He'd realize I'm right. And that would kill him even more. And he did this thing that to this day, I remember the physical motion. He would put both of his fists, like half clenched fists, up to his mouth. Like imagine he's wearing a football helmet and he's holding the like grill of the football helmet, right? So he'd like have him just away from his mouth, like holding the grid part, face mask of the of the football helmet.
Okay.
And he'd go like this. He'd hold him up. He'd go. He'd breathe really weird, and then he'd reach out like pantomime style, like he was grabbing your face, and then he put it back. Like he was. I always imagined in his mind he was reaching out and pantomime grabbing my face and then eating my face, like. Like, you know how, like, you squeeze, like, a thing that's a farther away, you'll squeeze your fingers together, like, you're squeezing it, you're pinching it from a distance, like, the play of distance. I always imagined in his mind he was reaching out and grabbing my face and then eating it. But he couldn't be mad at me because he got the math wrong 3-4 times a period, and he was genuinely wrong, but he also must have known that's the only attention I paid in his class. Like, I never looked up. Carrick would just tap me on the shoulder, I'd stop my note, I'd look at the board, raise my hand. You got that wrong again. And it got to the point where
he would look at the board again before calling on me. He'd see my hand, look at the board. He would never find the error, though, so he had to call on me to tell him where the mistake was and then have to fix it. I think he must have used – like, he was an old guy about to retire. I think he had been – the lore went that he was a football coach previously, and that's where the whole, like, face mask thing came from. It was the funniest – and I don't know that I ever learned anything from that guy. I don't know that I ever learned anything at all from him. And he just like gets so angry and just white haired, angry man trying to eat my face.
I just, I feel that it's a, I feel that your audience is lacking right now because this is not also a video podcast.
The visual didn't
and they could not really see exactly what that visual looked like. But I'll do my best. Small child afraid of something to begin with, hands in front of the mouth, and then the reach out like you're like you were just holding someone over a cliff and their hand slipped, yet you continue to reach as if you're going to be able to elongate your arm and grab them, like reaching with every fiber of your being, reaching. And he did this in front of the whole class.
Oh yeah, it's just right. He's always in the front of the room. It was like rows like a cemetery, and he's always in the front of the room. I was in the back corner.
I think there's something there. I think there's that's something undiagnosed.
Yeah,
he was a weird dude.
He's a very odd dude. Never learned anything from him though. And I just remember him being so angry and never being able to learn math from him at all. Actually, I have a string of bad math teachers.
He had a yearning
professors.
For face meat.
He wanted to
never eat anybody.
All the time. Yeah.
That was the problem. He had all these students whose faces he wanted to tear off and shove in his mouth, and he just didn't have the ability to do it.
He was way too focused on that and not the math, I guess. I was thinking about it. Like, I have a lot of bad people, bad math teachers in my career. I had a college professor who was absolutely awful that I managed to organize a group of like 70 students to go to the dean of education.
Yeah.
And try to say like, hey, this professor's terrible. He hasn't taught us anything and he's failing all of us.
I had some pretty mediocre math teachers when I was in high school. But I had a couple of really smart friends that sat on either side of me. So I was, you know, I was decently able to cheat my way through calculus and anything else. Because their level of proficiency in teaching math was about equal to their level of proficiency in actually scanning the classroom and seeing who was copying off somebody else's paper. okay, so this one extra question for you that I thought of just because of the type of person that you are and the type of things that you're passionate about and the type of things that you see in education every day, because you seem like a person who sees things in a way that's starkly different from the way a lot of educators see things. And I think that's because maybe you came into the world of education like a lot of people are these days, coming into the world of education when technology is at the forefront. And so that's what you've focused on. And that's been something that you've been passionate about, where people from, you know, decades ago weren't brought into education with that type of a focus. So what are some things that you hope to see in education in the future? Or where do you think, okay, I'm trying to figure out the most proficient way to phrase this question. If I walk into a classroom 15 years from now, if classrooms even exist 15 years from now, what are some things that you think we'll see, or what do you think are some things that people out there should be preparing for now, or should be looking into now because they're going to be norms in the future?
Well, the cynic in me says that if history tells us anything,
there will be classrooms.
It's that in 15 years, it'll look exactly like it looks right now. Because it was 120 years ago when we first started saying, hey, maybe education isn't working. And it's basically been exactly the same ever since. Despite the fact that we're all sitting here saying it doesn't work. But okay, ignoring that, let's say best case scenario. Let's talk about positives, right? Like, let's talk about what really will be happening.
Let's be those guys today.
Let's put on extra pieces of flair.
Yes, and pieces of flair.
What I would love to see realistically in 15 years is, first of all, a lot more student choice and a student voice. And and more importantly, the recognition that every student is different and we shouldn't keep teaching them all like they're the same. And I think that's number one. So what that would look like to me is a blended model where a go-to blended model where some classes might be taken online or some portion of classes might be taken online, or a large percentage of classes taken online, but there's still a physical space that they can go to interact with other students, that they can go to work collaboratively, that some assignments are done face to face and some are done online. Some lectures are done face to face and most are done through video online. Lecture limits its way down. We get rid of a lot of the testing. I don't, long term, I don't see that sticking around. That's this metric that is unnecessary long term. And eventually that has to, we are hitting the peak of testing. I feel like we've sort of started to hit that peak of where everything is tested. And I actually feel like we're starting to come our way down on that. A lot of states and countries are starting to step away from testing a lot. So I think that starts to take a backseat and we start to see student-driven learning, recognizing that students are independent and need to be the masters of their own destiny. We don't need to keep mass producing the same student. And I think those are the things that in 15 years we'll start to see a change is kids will all be on basically individualized education plans, where not only are the scaffolds and the stuff they need to get to the goals different, but each kid will have a different goal. And we can accomplish that through the use of technology in a way that we would not have been able to do previously.
And I'm glad that you didn't let me cut you off earlier because you answered the question I was going to ask in somewhat. But you did mention that there needs to be a movement in making sure that we are teaching each student differently. I don't like to call them kids.
No.
Even middle school, I still refer to them as students because I feel like the students take offense to being called kids.
Yeah.
So I do my best to try to call them students. That's just a little side note. But it is incredibly important to make sure that you're teaching students in a manner that's consistent with the way that they will best learn and what encourages them and what drives them. But I also feel like it's an important move that we start assessing students' knowledge in ways that also cater to their styles and their needs, because I think that's one of the most troubling things to look at is teachers spend so much time in their classrooms differentiating instruction and trying to use, I'll quote one of the people who commented on your Twitter feed, the Goldilocks approach, trying to make sure that you get kids, at a place where the learning is just right, where the level of intensity is just right and everything is just right. And they're getting things that are catered to them in the classroom, but then they get to the end of the year and every single one of them has to take the exact same test in the exact same form at the exact same time with the exact same provisions, with the exception of some students who get extended time. But I think it makes it incredibly difficult to really assess what they know if you're testing them all the exact same way. And I know that with 3 minutes to go, I should not.
We're not going to take on testing with three minutes left in our show.
Nope. I'm just going to say that. And just because you did touch on it, that some states are starting to back off of testing and some states are starting to give it less importance. Which I've always felt like a student's mastery of something should be shown by their success throughout the year from beginning to end. And that all of these scores and all these tests that they take from the beginning of the year to the end should be compounded to create their passing, you know. Anyway, so that's for another day.
Yeah.
For another time. Two minutes, dude.
We're going to hit the timer right on.
All right.
Not bad, man. Hey, wait, this is your show.
It is my show.
You have to wrap it up.
Brad Schreffler, it was really a pleasure having you on the Planning Period podcast today. I feel like we got a decent amount of information out there. If you guys have any questions for Brad, if you are at a school that lacks technology, if you're at a school that lacks leadership that's geared towards technology, if you are moving into a one-to-one situation and you need advice and you need pointers or you have questions or you just want to brainstorm with someone who's been through it and who's done a lot of things incredibly successfully in that realm of education, reach out to Brad on Twitter. He's at Brad Schreffler. That's S-H-R-E-F-F-L-E-R, since he's got a weird last name. Don't reach out to me on Twitter because you'll never find me. But reach out to Brad, let him know. And Brad, it's been excellent finally getting to interview you.
Yeah, thanks, Chip. I appreciate it. It was actually really fun. It was cool.
So yeah, you guys enjoy the rest of your Saturday. I'm definitely going to go enjoy the rest of mine. And we'll see you next time.
Thanks again for doing this with me, Chip, and taking over my show. It was an interesting hour, not steering my own ship, but it was also a lot of fun. If you'd like to reach out to Chip, you can actually find him on Twitter now since the recording of this episode. He's at Mr. Harbin. Mr. underscore Harbin. He never really tweets anything, but you can harass him there and he will see the notification. So that's something. If you have comments or questions about the show, you can always connect with me on Twitter. I'm at Brad Schreffler. I love to hear from you guys over there. And that's also a great place to connect if you'd like to be a guest on the show. I'm currently booking guests for the following month. Until next week, consider flipping the script on your normal routine. Music for the Planning Period podcast is the song Vicious by Kevin MacLeod, used under Creative Commons. You can find him at incompetech.com. The Planning Period podcast is also a proud member of the VoiceEd Radio Network, a 24-hour radio network all about education all the time. VoiceEd Radio. Your voice is right here.